You're listening to the Live Talk with Lamb podcast hosted by me, Todd Shapiro. All right, welcome back to episode 3. Thank you so much for hanging out with us again. Very grateful for all your time and all the great listeners here and learning from the one and only Brad Lamb, who I'm sitting next to. Hey, Brad.
How are you doing?
Good, bud. Real good. You know, hanging out, get to talk to you and get to learn, which is always important, and giving your thoughts, which I greatly admire anyway, and I, you know, highly implore others to have a listen and to check out what you're about to say. Your thoughts on youth and finances right now, are they being fiscally responsible?
I don't think so, but I have to say that I don't think any generation of youths are fiscally responsible. It's just the nature of being young, right? You don't want to save money, you want to spend it. You want to have the nice fast car. So there's lots of things that kids could do or parents could help kids with at a very early age. One of them would be just to make them aware of money and how you get money. Money, to me, in our lives today, the most important thing to be aware of. Because without money, life's not possible. Unfortunately, it's not. We can hope that there's some utopian dream down the road, but there isn't, because people won't work unless they get paid, and they won't work hard and extra hours unless they get paid more money. So money is the center of humans' existence today, and the people need to understand how to get it, how to save it, how to make it.
Do you have advice for those to conserve and to budget well?
Like I said, the first thing is to understand that, you know, everyone should be working. I think kids should start working young. You know, they should understand work. Parents could put their kids to work in their home at 8, 9, 10. My father made me shovel the driveway and do the lawn, you know, mow the lawn and clip the grass. And I was the guy that had to do it even though there were three of us, somehow it came to me to do, and didn't pay me anything really, but I had jobs to do. And then, you know, because I had those jobs, I went off and I sold my services. I used my parents' equipment and I sold my services along the street at a very young age. 10 years old, I was mowing lawns and earning money. So I think the parents should really embrace the understanding of it. It's not debasing their kid, you know, to learn about dirty, grubby money. It's important for them to understand the value of it and how to save.
And in terms of, you know, say parenting now with children, me being a father, do you think there's a social fear of parents now even like pushing younger children, like, hey, encouraging them, you know, let's do this, you know, because I'm from the same, maybe a little bit of a younger generation than you, but my dad also made me work very young. My first job, I lied my age to work at Canadian Tire. I think he had to be 15 and I was 13 at the time. Lied on the resume, worked in the housewares department. And I feel like, is it different these days? And are parents maybe fearing that?
Well, I don't think many kids would start at 13. I think parents would have a hard time. I think maybe 13 is younger today than it was when you were 13, mm-hmm. when I was 13. But listen, I think parents, first of all, should give their kids an allowance. If they, you know, nothing large, but for doing work around the house. Once they get to a certain age, and they need to understand that work is compensated by money, and so that can be done quickly and easily with an allowance, and having jobs they have to do in order to obtain the allowance. And then they need to understand about bank accounts. You know, my kid's 6. She's got multiple piggy banks, and she's extorted money from all of us for various transgressions. But she's shortly going to start to be put on that train where she needs to understand what a dollar really is. And it's just that simple. Just talk to your kids about it. Put them on allowance. Get them encouraged to get a job as soon as they can, you know, an after-school job.
How important is it for parents to educate their children about real estate, about the stock market, about, you know, investments, things like this? And is that important? And maybe are parents not doing that enough as well?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we put a lot of stock in, you know, business degrees and commerce degrees. And I can tell you, and, you know, development education, I can tell you that, and I don't want to oversimplify what real estate's about. But I'm going to oversimplify it. It's just simple. The rent has to be higher than your costs of owning the property. And as a developer, the income has to be higher than the cost of developing the property. It's that simple. And so the job of either a landlord or a developer is in pursuit of making a profit and finding ways to do that. Now, there's a skill in that. Obviously, it's not an automatic thing. But I'll give you an example. If you want to buy a property in Toronto, basically you need to borrow money to get a mortgage, and the capital stack, meaning what you use to buy the property with, is a mortgage and your equity. So your equity has to be 20% in income properties now in Toronto or in Canada. So 80% is the maximum debt you can have. So the cost of borrowing 80% or that kind of mortgage, you can go on the internet or you can get the old time tables that I still use. I have a slide table in my office that I use. I can find out what a mortgage costs right away. And then you basically take the cost of the mortgage and you add on the cost of owning the property, which would be the property taxes, and some maintenance element, if you're going to pay the maintenance versus a tenant paying the maintenance. And those are your costs. Insurance is a small item you could put in there too. And then your rent has to be larger than that. And in Toronto, it's still possible to find that. It's harder to do it, but it's still possible. And you can use that anywhere you live. And you could live in Azerbaijan. If the same rules apply. The rent needs to exceed the cost of ownership. A lot of people get freaked out about being a landlord. It's not hard. Collect the rent. Make sure the property's nice and well-maintained. The tenants will pay the rent. It's as simple as that.
Before those people would even have the opportunity to be a landlord, they'd have to be owners. And now that we talked about, say, you know, starting young and working and everything, getting back now to maybe 20-year-olds, that decade 20 to 30, where you are maybe spending a little more frivolously than you would and you want the nice cars, should they be saving to have ownership as opposed to rent, or should they be saving to have an investment property as opposed to just throwing it away?
Well, that's a great question. So when I was in my early 20s, I had a goal of being a millionaire by the time I was 30. And by the way, that was a lot of money at 30. That was a long time ago. I wanted to be worth $10 million when I was 40, $100 million when I was 50, and I wanted to be a billionaire when I was 60. I had that goal. And there's no easy way to achieve that goal. I mean, unless you invent, you know, Facebook or something that becomes an absurdly successful corporation. But those things you can count in your hands, right? The average person has to work very, very hard to become wealthy. And the only way to do it is to save capital and then put that capital to work for you, right? While you're sleeping, while you're working in your normal job, you want to have capital invested for you that works while you're doing something else. So what I did, and I said in one of the earlier episodes that I read all the business books and all the investment books and the Warren Buffett books and, you know, all of them. I read everything I could in my 20s to learn about because I was interested. And what I did was I lived at home. I got out of school when I was 22. I got a job. I got $22,000 a year in 1984 was my payment for being an engineer. You know, my mother was nice enough, my father was nice enough to not charge me room and board. So I lived there for free. I saved all my money. I bought a crappy car. I bought a used Jetta. The Jetta's a good car, but it was a used one. I didn't buy a new one. And I had to have a car for work. I saved every dollar I could, and I invested every single dollar. So what happened is, by the time I was 30, I was a millionaire. I owned many, many properties that I'd bought from 20 to 30 years old. I was a squirrel. I saved everything I could. And I invested my money, and when I made money, I didn't go out and celebrate and buy myself something special. I reinvested it. And so what happened is all my contemporaries I went to school with, by the time I was 30, I was the richest of all my contemporaries that I knew, even guys that were working in Bay Street that were stock promoters or brokers or in management. I had more money than them, and I wasn't making a lot as an engineer. So that's one of the reasons I quit being an engineer is because I was making more money being in real estate, so I got my real estate license when I was 27. But the lesson from this is you need to live below your means. So if you're making $30,000 or $40,000 a year, you can't spend all that money. You need to save your money. So the book, The Richest Man in Babylon, I believe, tells you, and also The Wealthy Barbers, I think save 10%. I think that's what they said. And you save it in something that while you're sleeping, learn money, like the stock market or a mutual fund or an index fund or all the different things you could do today, or real estate. I saved like 40% of what I made. I really was very tight with money until I was 30. And once I was 30, I got myself a Cartier watch, which to me was like a Cartier Santos was the watch, you know. And I bought myself a BMW 7 Series. So at 30, that's a pretty boss car, right? But I suffered with used cars all the way until I was at that point where I felt, okay, I was making a couple $100,000 a year as a real estate agent. I had $1 million net worth, you know, on a good day with wind in my back. And I felt, okay, I can give myself something. So the key to this story is that there's nothing wrong with living at home. There's nothing wrong with eating your mom's cooking. It's probably better than your cooking. And, you know, sure, you can't be the player and do all that stuff that you want to do. But what happens is when you hit 30 or 35 or whatever it is, when you actually leave the house, you have money, which is a lot easier to save when you're young than when you're older. And if you put it into play when you're young, it has the value of time to make you rich.
What about the risk factor for some? And, you know, you're a businessman, you have experience, you know this stuff. But for some who have a little bit extra money to, you know, just stomach the idea that it is sitting there somewhere, whether it's in the market or something's paying you a dividend, it's a little more safer of a blue chip stock or even in real estate. Are some just not cut to go and put it back in to let it work for them? Is that a scary feeling for some, especially when, you know, think of a 23-year-old, for example. Is it daunting?
So, you know, there's the old adage of the tortoise and the hare. So when you're 20 and you're a guy or a woman, you want all the things that you see on Instagram or in magazines or in movies. You want to be out there bawling and looking like you're successful when in fact you're not. You want it before you have it. What you need to do is, if you are patient and you invest your money when you're young, and you get the benefit of compounding your money, compounded interest or compound investment, which means that if you make 18% 1 year, so now you've got your $1 plus 18%, and then the next year you get 18%, you're adding 18% to the original 18% you got, and so on and so on and so on. And that's what makes you rich. It's the compounding effect. So you look at like someone like Warren Buffett, his funds over, let's say he's been in the business 60 years. If you were very early in his first fund, and you put, say, $10,000 into that fund, over 50 years, you'd be a multimillionaire today, for sure. From that. And that's astonishing, that small amount of money. Even though, you know, in 1950, $10,000 got you a house. Today it gets you a house, a yacht, and another, you know, $5 or $10 million in the bank. So it's far wiser to get the benefit of time compounding money and getting it to work early, because the more years you have that your money's working for you, the more money you have. And so if you start doing it when you're 20 versus 30, versus 40, you just have less time to have the benefit of compounding make you rich. And I want to tell you a quick story. My nephew, my brother's youngest kid, when he was 18 and he went to university, 19 maybe, he was going to Guelph, University of Guelph for hotel management, I think. He had saved $30,000 by working at McDonald's. He worked at McDonald's from the earliest age, and he ended up being an assistant store manager. Now, this meant he didn't have much of a life when he was a teenager. He wasn't dating girls and drinking and doing drugs and all the fun stuff that's probably not right or best to do when you're a teenager. Some of it's probably okay, but a lot of it's not. He didn't do that. Here's the thing. He bought a house when he was 19 years old. My dad co-signed the mortgage. He bought a house for $180,000. He's almost 30 years old now in his late 20s, and that house is worth $400,000 or $500,000 today. This kid has a net worth of over $300,000 in his late 20s. None of his friends have any money. They don't have anything in the bank. Some of them are still looking for work. So you see, just that one thing, by the time he's 28, now he can come to Toronto, he can buy a house with his $300,000 or $400,000 equity, and he can live in the most expensive city in Canada and probably the third or fourth most expensive city in North America. He can do it now, and he's 27, 28, something like that.
Is there some anxiety that comes with investing where you will now save? You listen to Brad, I'm going to work hard for the next 4 years. I got an excess of $70,000 because I saved 50% of every single salary I ever earned over that time. And is there anxiety that comes with that, putting it in? And you know, can some people just not stomach putting their money to work for them, not having control over it?
Sure. I mean, it does, you know, when you put your money in the bank and you're getting 1% or 2% interest, there's no risk and you can wake up every day and go, hey, I'm making money. But you're not making money because inflation is roughly the same as what you're earning. So you're actually just treading water. Of course, when you want to make 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 20, 30, 40% a year on your money, and you can make 40 or 50% a year on your money if you are aggressively investing, it's risky. That's the whole key. The higher the rate of return, the more the risk. But the thing about real estate is it's really not that risky. And I'll tell you why. If you buy a property and you finance it and the rent exceeds your costs, you take that money and you don't spend it. You put it in a rainy day fund. The money you're making on your property, you put away for maybe there's a time when the economy sinks a bit and you have it empty for a little bit. That money helps you weather those bad times. There may never be a bad time where it's not rented, but there might be. The thing about real estate is to think about forever, not I'm going to buy it, I'm going to rip it apart and flip it. I hate these shows, these flipping shows. I hate them. They promote the wrong idea. That's not the right idea. Buying a house and flipping it is stupid. You're not making the money. The money is in the long-term appreciation of the house. Have a tenant pay your mortgage for you. Have a tenant pay all your costs for you. And after 25 years of owning investment property, the worst case scenario is you own it outright. You have no debt. It's unbelievable. It's the only investment you can make where you can have someone else pay all your bills, not a penny out of your pocket except the initial money. And at the end of it, you own it 100%. And the likelihood is after 25 years, it's probably tripled or quadrupled in value. One house can make you a millionaire in 25 years in Canada. One house purchase.
We're hanging out in Toronto, where I'm talking to you, and you often hear in this city anyway, that it's too late, it's impossible. I can never afford to buy a home in Toronto ever again. What do you say to those people?
I've heard that every day of my adult life. You know, I asked my father that. My father felt that way in 1967 when he bought a back split bungalow or whatever it was called. It was a strange house that was multi-level with stairs everywhere. He paid $70,000 and he couldn't believe it. It was unfathomable to pay that kind of money for a house. It's always been the case. Houses have always been too expensive. You go back and read things 40, 50 years ago about people trying to buy a house, the same struggles. Everywhere, in every country, in every place, in every time, you've always thought you've missed the boat. And guess what? You never have. You know why? Because the population of the world is going to continue to grow. Land will continue to get more scarce, and people will need a place to live. They need a place to live. So your house will go up in value over a long period of time.
Is there a fear that only a certain amount of people will own most of the property and the rest will just be renters? And is that good for the market or bad for the market?
Well, I think as an individual, you can't worry about the world in that sense. I mean, I think you can worry about the world in terms of global warming and the bigger picture items, but I think what you need to worry about is yourself when it comes to housing initially. Get yourself a house. And don't worry about your friend or your neighbor and what they're doing with that. It's their business. But if you listen to me, I'm going to tell you will never regret buying your home if you can afford it. And when I say you can afford it, you're going to think you can't afford it. But if you have enough money to pay your bills and scrimp for a few years, you can afford it.
I've known you for quite some time, and I remember once you told me it's okay to not only just take the risk, but sort of get outside of your comfort zone a bit, because it does force you in a way to work harder, maybe work a couple extra hours, maybe not buy the avocado toast and put that towards your home. And you still preach that a little bit, where it's okay to challenge yourself a little bit, and by that meaning it's okay to take a little debt because you'll work hard to pay it off.
You know, it's avocado toast. Where did avocado toast come from?
Dude,
like 5 years ago, no one ever ate avocados.
It's
now
ridiculous.
It's everywhere.
And it's 14 bucks, and it's a piece of bread with a little avocado.
I like avocado toast, but it's odd. You know, I'll tell you an interesting thing. You know, in the United States, the average net worth of a tenant is $5,000, okay? The average net worth of a homeowner is $330,000.
Wow.
Think about that. Go and talk to a financial advisor anywhere working in North America. They'll tell you, you could be the same. If you're a tenant, you can end up with the same amassed wealth as a homeowner. Don't be deluded by the guys like Brad Lamb that sell homes and are pushing you to buy a home. Don't be deluded by that. But this is a fact. Tenants in the United States have an average net worth of $5,000. And 75% of Americans cannot afford a $1,000 increase in costs in a month. They're out of business. They're done. $1,000. And that's because they're tenants. They're not homeowners. So, you know, the problem with being a tenant, and this is all about the human condition. What do you do if your bank account has some extra money in it? What do you do?
Well, I spend it.
Bingo. If people have money in their bank account, they're like, you know, honey, let's go to Cancun. We've got 20 grand in our bank account, right? Let's go buy a new car. Let's get a new couch, right? What they should be doing is taking that surplus and trying to equal the gains that they would get if they lived in a house. So if your rent is $1,000 and owning a house is $2,000, that extra $1,000 that you're saving by not being a homeowner should be going somewhere and being invested. And if you do that, you wouldn't be worth zippo as a tenant. But the problem is humans don't do that. Humans look at their bank account and they live vicariously day to day. And that's why you should buy a home. Because if you buy a home, you have a forced savings plan. The bank is going to kick you on the street if you don't pay your mortgage. If you don't pay your taxes, the city will take your house and they'll sell it and you're on the street. And there's nothing like that fear of being booted from your house that makes you make the payments. You give up something. You give up that pair of Louboutins. You give up that trip to Cancun. You give up that new car. Maybe you stretch your car an extra 5 years, whatever. But you do it. And at the end of the day, you saved money because you've been forced to. And that's why buying a house, that's why these financial advisors say you'd be the same. They're not being truthful to you. Because if you take human behavior and you say we're not going to behave like humans, yes, you'd be the same. But because we spend more than we should spend, everywhere in the world we do that.
And I'll just add my two cents and maybe feel what or get you to add to it. But owning especially a condominium now, as opposed to renting, I think is good for future generations too, if you ever have children. So if you owned a condo in Toronto now and then you outgrew it, you could keep it, rent it, and then maybe your own child can move in there one day. Is that something important that people should be thinking about? Generational?
Absolutely. You know, that's one of the seminars that we put on here, is how to teach parents when their kids are as young as two or three, or they're just having a kid. Think about this. In 16, 18, 20 years, when your kid is of age to buy a home, are they going to be able to buy a home in the city you live in? And the answer is going to be not a chance. They won't be able to. Unless your kid is getting, your child's being well-educated and understands the use of money and you can help with that. But why not keep the home, rent it, and buy another home? Just refinance it and keep a second home. And if that's all you do and you have one child, your child has got a great start in life. Then your child has something. And by the way, the house will be owned in 25 years. So there will be no mortgage, right? What a great gift to give your 25-year-old child, a home without debt.
Don't just waste. Don't just throw it away. Think about your future, and Brad Lamb's helping you do that. We'll be back with episode 4. So thanks for chilling with us. Thanks, Brad. If you have any questions for us, please hit us up at info@lamdevcorp.com. That's info@lamdevcorp.com. If you enjoy listening to Live Talk with Lamb, make sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Thanks.